Hi, I'm Megan. I'm an addict.
Hey.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right, great. I'm going to take a moment and just try to get out of the way. All right. As Jason said, he met me through service, and I love being of service to Narcotics Anonymous. This is probably my least favorite way to be of service to Narcotics Anonymous. And the truth is that, like, our basic text talks about how we're, like, egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. And so, like, every time I'm asked to speak, like, I feel like that gets real activated for me. I'm like, oh, I'm gonna do great. No one wants to fucking hear you. You have nothing to say, you know, and then it gets like, it's like, you know, I almost wish that, like, sometimes the egomaniac is as strong as, like, the inferiority, because, like, that voice is always so much louder, and, you know, so it's always a really hard thing to come up here and be vulnerable and to tell the truth, but that's, it's my story, and it's all I have to offer, right? And, you know, our stories are unique, but our experiences and, you know, the pain we share and go through is, like, always sort of, like, that's the empathy that we can always kind of tap into, that, like, when we relate to one another. So I'm just going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today to the best of my ability, and I might go in order, and I might not. I never know what's going to come out. So I'm from Pittsburgh, PA. I grew up in Pittsburgh. I've never lived anywhere else. My parents actually met at a recovery club. At one point during my life, I thought they met in rehab, and when I found out they met at this, like, in the Anala Club, I was, like, actually thought that was worse. like, that's embarrassing, Mom. And they went to a different fellowship. So, like, I grew up with, like, there was no drugs and alcohol in my house. My grandfather was actually in a 12-step program. My grandmother was in a 12-step program. My uncle was in a 12-step program. My aunt was in a 12-step program. You know, and so, like, I've always known about, like, a 12-step program, like, my entire life. And I have an older brother who's, like, 18 months older than me, and, around the time I was 4, my parents actually divorced, and my mom married some other man. He had 6 kids, like, 3 of them were, like, my mom's age, which should have been a red flag, and 3 of them were, like, mine and my brother's age. And, you know, like, shortly after that, like, my dad decided to move to Colorado, and I think, you know, my stepfather started abusing me before he had even left. And one of the things I absolutely love about Narcotics Anonymous is that, like, people, like, say things that, like, kind of, like, bring clarity to me. And it's like someone, like, will say something from the podium that I think I've been the only person who's ever felt in my, like, you know, like, that alienation. And I remember some woman shared from the podium once, like, one of the worst things that you can do to a child is make them feel different than the other children in a home. And she was literally a redheaded stepchild. And as far as I know, I was the only child out of all these kids that was being abused by my stepfather. And when she said that, it really hit home, because I was like, oh, damn, like, no one's ever, like, put words to my experience before. And, you know, because of that, I didn't feel, like, quite so alone. And I also kind of got a better understanding of, like, my pain. And, you know, what ended up happening was, like, around the age of, like, 11 or 12, I tried to kill myself, but, like, you know, didn't really know how to kill myself. And so I took a bunch of ibuprofen, and I got sick to my stomach, and I threw up, and I got to stay home from school. And I was like, okay, that didn't work. But shortly after that, me and my friends, like, I was a scholar student, and me and my friends were just, like, sitting in class one day, and we're like, you know what would be a good idea? Like, if we, like, tried drugs. And I was like, that sounds like a good idea. And we got all our money together. This is really embarrassing. We got all our money together, and we asked her older sister to go buy us some weed. And I'm pretty sure that they, like, went and they bought the weed and they smoked it, and they told me they had a really good time. Like, somehow I was not invited, and I got kicked in money. So I got beat, like, the very first time I ever tried to get high. And they were like, it was so much fun, you should give us more money, we should do it again. I was like, okay. And, like, the progression of the disease is, like, so the next time they got the weed, like, I smoked it, I don't even know if I was high. I remember acting weird in a field. And the progression of the disease is, like, that happened when I was in, like, 7th grade. And by the time I was in 8th grade, I was using something every day. I don't remember the first time I picked up a drink, and not because I blacked out, just because it was just so seamless. It was like, once I found something, it was just like I was off to the races. And what ended up happening on my 13th birthday, I got taken home by the police. And my stepfather said to me, like, we don't need to tell your mom. So, like, my mom was a nurse. She worked night shifts. And at one point in time, he had stopped abusing me. And I think it was because I was getting older and he was afraid I was going to say something. But he caught me smoking and he didn't tell my mom. And I had been brought home by the police for shoplifting and he didn't tell my mom. But like this one, I was like, no, we got to tell my mom, because I just felt like it was too big of a thing. And so my mom woke up and, you know, I got sat down on the couch to be disciplined. And he was like, this is a really serious thing. I got brought home by the police because I had asked someone to go to the liquor store and buy me a bottle of alcohol. And again, like, I grew up in a house where he was also in a 12-step fellowship. So, like, there was no drugs and alcohol in my house. So he was telling me what a serious thing it was. And, like, a very snarky teenager, I was like, if it's so serious, why don't you want to tell my mom? And she looked at me, she looked at him, and she sent me to my room. And the next day she asked me what was going on. And I was honest with her. And, like, at first she did all the right things, and, you know, she had him move out. And, but then for the next year, she spent all of her time at his place. And, like, his kids went with him. And, so it was just me and my brother at my house. And like I said, he's 18 months older than me. So I'm 13 and he's 14 and we're just living in a house. And so our house became the house where people just came to get high. And I remember one day my stepbrother was at my house and they were going through my mom's stuff. And I was like, what are you doing in mom's room? They're like, well, mom's getting high now, so we're looking for her drugs. And I was like, no way. And like then they found it, and we all got high. So, you know, a year later, when I turned 14, right before I turned 14, my mom got sent home from work because she had been caught diverting narcotics. Like I said, she was a nurse. And I always like to say that NA saved my life twice. It saved my life the first time when she got clean. Because she got clean again when I was 14, and she stopped seeing my stepfather, and she got her life back together. And I just continued to use, though. And I continued to use, like, all through high school. I barely graduated high school. I always say, like, to me, like, you know, the progression of my disease didn't go very far. And like, people talk about having a head full of NA and relapsing and how hard it is to use. Like, I would literally like trip on acid and then like read the Just for Today book because it was in the bathroom. And like, my friends would start doing like other drugs and I'd like look at them and be like, do I want to go to the bitter ends? Like, And it was like, I knew on some level that I had a problem, but I wasn't ready to stop. And you know, what ended up happening was, like, one day I was out with my friends and I was driving home, and I ran into a telephone pole. I was alone in the car when I ran into the telephone pole, and the first thing I did was try to like leave the scene, and I tried to put the car in reverse and nothing happened, and then I tried to move my leg and nothing happened, and I think I tried to start the car, like I never turned the car off, but like also nothing happened, and then I passed out and I woke up to the police cutting me out of the car. And you know, I was like whisked away to, you know, Presby Hospital, and like I had almost died, right? Like I had snapped my femur in half. The first doctor who looked at me told my mom I was never going to walk normal again. I have a cut that goes up and over this eye and behind my ear, which is why I will always have my side part. My millennial side part forever. You know, like I almost bled to death, and you know, I spent 4 days in the hospital. And, you know, my mom had her home group's anniversary that week. And I remember her and another gentleman came to see me in the hospital before she went to, like, go chair. I think she was chairing and he was speaking for her. And, you know, like, I remember being in the hospital and, you know, looking at the social worker and just saying to the social worker in front of my mom, like, I really just wish I would have died. You know, we talk about, like, we live to use and use to live. And to me, like, the only thing I was really, like, living for at that point in time was, like, to get high. Because it was, like, the only way to cope with the pain that I had felt. And, like, I didn't really know what to do. Like, every day that I was using, like, I wanted to fucking die. And, like, I tried, like I said, I tried to kill myself when I was, like, 11 years old. And that feeling never really went away. And I tried again when I was a little bit older. And, you know, it's a long story. But I wasn't successful then either. And, like, so it was, like, every day just wanting to die and, you know, just using to cope with that. And I remember my mom crying when I said, I really wish I would have, like, well, I really wish I would have died. And I remember thinking to myself, what is wrong with you? Like, why would that upset you? Like, what's, you know, like, and like, to me, that's the self-centeredness of this disease. Like, you know, like, and like having children now, like, they're not me, like, no, they're not biologically my children, but they're my children. Like, I couldn't imagine if my kids, like, wanted to hurt themselves. You know, it'd be so heartbreaking. and so, like, now I understand it. But at the time, I was, like, kind of like, get it together, Mom. Shortly after that, the same person who came to hear, to see me in the hospital, to visit me, he was a window washer person, like a high-rise window washer person. And he fell off of PNC Park and broke his back. And in my twisted thinking, I was like, I bet he's not going to use his perks. I bet I can get them from him. And then it was like, again, like I had this head full of NA too. It's like, Megan, a recovering addict's not going to give you their drugs. What the fuck is wrong with you? But it was like those little types of thoughts that made me start to, like, I always say my well of denial was so fucking thin. You know, it was just so fucking thin. And so it was like shortly after that, that like I decided that I was going to control my using. And I was only going to do a little bit to feel a little bit. And then I was going to stop. And so the first time I tried to put that plan into action, I put a little bit in me and all I wanted was more. And I decided after that, that like, you know what? I think I have a problem. And there was a woman, my mom sponsored, who lived down the street from me. And since I had broken my leg, she would come over and she would sit with me. And I had known this woman for a couple of years. And she had recently come back from a relapse. She had about like 60 days at the time. And I remember saying to her, like, do you think I have a problem? And she was like, only you can answer that question for yourself. And she was like, but if you think you have a problem, why don't you get the basic text and read Who's an Addict out of it? Like, that would help you. And so I went into my mom's study and I found the basic text and I sat down and I thought, I'll read this later. And so after she had left that night, I read that chapter out of the basic text, and it was like someone had written a book about me. All the thoughts and the feelings that they put in that chapter, I was like, God damn, like I've experienced this. Like, this is my story. And I still had like some pain pills from like breaking my leg, because, you know, I did. And my first thought was like, go take something, forget what you read, because if you admit to yourself you have a problem, then you're gonna have to do something about it. And then there was another voice of me, it was like, well, what the fuck are you gonna do? Like, just keep using? Like, it was like literally like at the end of the road, I was like, And I ended up not using, I ended up flushing my perks. And ever since I read Who's an Addict of the basic text, I've never used again. My clean date is May 20th, 2003.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, and I got clean when I was 20 years old. And so I don't even know what day that was. So like whenever I stopped using, is it the day I used as my clean date? May 20th was the day I went to our Narcotics Anonymous meeting and picked up a white key tag. And I've just used that as my clean date for the last whatever 22 years. And so I made the decision after I read Who Is an Addict in the basic text, that I was going to try this way of life. And so I went to a meeting with the same friend who suggested that I read the basic text. And before the meeting, a friend of ours was chairing the meeting. And before the meeting, we sat in the kitchen and we went over the pamphlet, Am I an Addict? Now, I had been court ordered to go to meetings at some point when I was a teenager. And I remember the only question I could say no to was like, have you ever used a loan? And so I held on to that for like fucking years. Like I would be like, you're with me, I'm not a fucking addict. And I remember the first time I did use a loan, I was like, oh no. Like I said, the whole time I used, it was just like, la la la. And so I sat down in the kitchen and I was able to answer yes to like every single question in that pamphlet. And then I went and I picked up a white key tag. And like I said, that was May 20th, 2003. And this meeting was huge. I mean, there was probably like 100 people in it, and it had like this big giant love line. And like, I still had a broken leg. I was finally allowed to put weight on it again, but I was using like one crutch, and I'm bawling my eyes out. And I go up and I pick up a white key tag, and this woman hugged me and she pulled me in really, really close, and she said, "You're only crying because you mean it." And by the time, and most people wouldn't even hug me, they like, I think they were afraid to knock me over, they were hugging me all like ass out, like this, but like she really gripped me up. And by the time I got back to my seat, she had passed me a pamphlet for the newcomer, I think I still have it, with a list of women's phone numbers, and she said, "Call us." And I called her and I asked her to be my sponsor. And so when I was new, when I first came in, I always describe it as that, like, it physically hurt me if people noticed me. Like, I wanted to be invisible so damn badly. And if you talked for me to too long, I just started crying. Like, it just came out of me. Like, there was, like, no choice. Like, I just felt, like, inside out. And, like, everything was, like everything. Like, it was, like, just being, like, just the most sensitive human being in the world. So, like, I would go to meetings, and they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And so I would go to a meeting, and they told me to sit in the front. They told me to show up early and stay late. They told me to sit in the front. But I'd, like, go to these meetings, and I'd sit in the front, and everyone else be in the back or outside smoking. And I wasn't smoking. So, like, I would, like, sit in this one meeting, and I would, like, look at the clock, and I'd be, like, literally, like, hanging on, like, ball of anxiety. Like, when is it going to be 8 o'clock so this meeting starts? And from 8 to 9, I felt fine. And as soon as that meeting was over, I'd run for the door. So, like, I did not take all of the suggestions, like, in stride. Like, it took me a really long time to really, like, get the we part of the fellowship, because, like, people were fucking scary. Because it hurt if you noticed me. But I had a few people that, like, were my go-to people. Like I said, like, I called that woman, I asked her to be my sponsor. The woman who lived down the street from me, who was my mom's sponsee, like, me and her, like, hung out. Like, so when I picked up my white key tag, she picked up 90 days. Like I said, she had just come back from a relapse recently. And so we, like, went to meetings all the time. And, you know, like, there was a few other people who knew me and they knew who my mom was. So they would, like, kind of be like, "All right, we're going out after the meeting." And so, like, I had a few people that I felt comfortable with, and I, like, clung to them. And I just feel like that invisible person kind of just, like, walking behind people, like, "I'm here." And they, the next thing they told me to do was get a home group. And, you know, I got a home group for, like, the first, like, 90 days I was clean. But then I had to get another one because I got a job. And it interfered with, like, the time that I worked. So, you know, I ended up switching. And so, like, I always consider, like, the second home group that I had my first real home group. And it was this meeting that was in the walking distance of my house. It was on Sunday nights. There was no job I was ever going to have that was going to interfere with it. Like, that was so important for me. And like I said, I was like this shy little girl. And so all the home group members used to sit on this side of the room and I would sit over here by myself. And one home group member, right, like would come and he would sit next to me and he would slide me a reading. And like, that's all I did every week, which is read this one little reading. And, eventually, you know, like they asked me to chair the meeting. And so I asked somebody, I was like, "What do you do when you chair a meeting?" They said, "Well, make sure you show up early. You know, and, other than that, you just read the format." And I was like, "Okay, I can do that." And so I show up to my home group early. And like, again, I was showing up early, but I wasn't showing up an hour early. And by the time I was there, everything was set up. But I showed up an hour early when I had like probably like 6 months clean. And one woman was setting up a meeting for like 100 people. And once I found that out, I was like, I showed up early every week after that. And I helped her. And so, of course, when I had a year and they needed a new secretary, because at this home group, the secretary set up the meeting, they were like, "Do you want to be our secretary? You know how to do everything." And I was like, "Yes, it would be an honor." And so by the time I had a year clean, like I was the secretary of this home group, and it was a real rowdy meeting. Like I said, it was like 100 people in this meeting. And so I'd have to like learn how to like use my voice. So like I went from this girl who like literally would cry to talk to me to a woman who was able to be like, "Yo, like get your kids under control. you know, like keep your side conversations down." Like, and I was able to kind of like project that and like had a little bit of confidence to me. And at the same time, all this is going on, I'm working steps with my sponsor. You know, like I dove into the steps right away. I was very grateful for the first sponsor I had. Like the first time I called her, because I even said to someone, I was like, "Okay, I have a sponsor now. What?" They said, "You work steps with a sponsor." And I, so I called her and I was like, "You're my sponsor. So how do I work steps?" And she was like, "Do you have a basic text?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "Read the first step out of the basic text, write about how to pleasure your life. When you think you're done, call me and we'll go over it." And she just like kept it so simple. And so I was working steps with her, and so, you know, like, that was the other thing. Like, along with being of service to my home group, like, that process of, like, you know, going through the steps, like, helped to, like, build back the parts of me that had been lost. So, like I said, like, that home group really helped, like, restore that part of me, and give me, like, a sense of purpose. And then through this process of the steps, like, I really started to get in touch with, like, who I was. So the first step, you know, we admitted we were powerless over our addiction, that our lives have become unmanageable. When I first approached the first step, I was really clear on the unmanageability of my, like, I wasn't actually really clear on the unmanageability of my life. Like, I was 20 years old. Like, I still had a job. I was still in school. You know, like, but for me, the unmanageability was the fact that I was driving around, like I said, wanting to die every day. Like, to me, that was, like, unmanageable. I was literally, like I said, I was in school, but I was, like, tutoring a guy and then showing up the next day and being so out of my mind that I had to cheat off of him, in order to pass my classes. Like, you know, and as my first sponsor put it to me when I went over it, she said, look, like, you were lucky. Like, you got out when you got out, but if you would have continued, like, she was like, it was like you were juggling a bunch of balls in the air. Like, they were all going to drop eventually. And then my second sponsor liked to be a little bit tougher, and she'd be like, you almost died. She would, like, tell me that all the time. Like, because one of the things that happens to me is that my head likes to tell me that I was just young and I just had emotional problems and that, like, maybe I don't really need to be here anymore. And she'd always look at me and be like, the disease almost killed you. You belong. What else do you need? And I'd be like, okay. You know, and the powerless part, right? Like, I'm really happy I tried my little experiment of, like, I'm just going to get a little bit high. Because it fucking failed miserably. And there was a guy in the area where I got clean who used to talk about his switch. And he'd say, my switch is broken. And he said, when my switch is on, it stays on until a power greater than myself turns it off. And once it's off, it's my job to keep it in the off position. And if I turn it back on, all bets are off. And that's how I always look at it, because, like, that was my experience. It's like, once I take one, all I want is more. All I want is more. And I can still be like that today with other things. So, you know, so I go over step one with my sponsor, and that was, you know, part of my experience. I went over reservations. At one of the times, one of my reservations was turning 21. And I remember my 21st birthday, I was driving, my birthday's right after Christmas, and I was driving with my boyfriend to his, like, uncle's house for a Christmas party, and he was driving. I was teaching my boyfriend how to drive, and he slammed on the brakes real suddenly, and this bottle of alcohol shoots out from the seat underneath me, and I was like, where the fuck did this come from? I was like, it's my 21st birthday, and there's a bottle of Grey Goose? Like, what the fuck, God? And, like, I was, like, I was very confused. And then I remembered I had taken my brother to our family's house on Christmas Eve. And I was, like, that asshole put this bottle of alcohol under my seat. And, so I'm ashamed to admit this, but I asked him to pull over and we just chucked it into the woods. I don't like littering. But I'd rather litter than fucking die. So I faced that reservation with grace. And so step two, you know, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I was determined to not have a God when I got here. Like, I was, like, adamant that God didn't exist. And so I was really cool with the idea of a higher power, though. And so when I first approached, like, step two, like, to me, the idea of a higher power was simply the group and the program. And I'm, like, a very practical, logical type of person, and I like tangible, like, things to show me that things work. And so the way I practiced step two was, like, I came to believe that if I had a problem, I would go to a meeting, I would bring it up as a topic, and I would listen for the answer, right? And that, to me, was how the group was a power greater than me and how I would be restored to sanity, right? So, like, I would go and I'd be like, I'm turning 21 and I'm scared. People would be like, you'll be fine. This is what I did, right? Like, that would be an example of that. And, you know, when I talk about the program, like, I thought about the evidence that I had seen with my mother and how broken she had been and how she was thriving in life. having come back and worked this thing, and the other people that I knew through her who were living this way of life, right? Like, it was such a powerful experience of, like, seeing it work in other people's lives, and so coming to believe that if I also worked this program, that, like, I could have a thriving life like they did. And so that was step two for me. I didn't pay a lot of attention. Like, I know a lot of people... Okay, I'm gonna get on my, like, little soapbox for a minute. I know a lot of people talk about step two when they're like, I'm being insane, I need step two. I'm like, no, you need to go back to step one. If you're still doing the same thing and expecting different results, you haven't admitted that you're powerless, you haven't stopped. Yeah, manageability is the insanity to me. And so to me, like, when I practice step two, like, I've already admitted that I'm insane, because I'm admitting that me of my own power and my own, like, control is not fixing this situation, and now I need to do something different, right? So to me, that's like that bridge to, like, from one to two to three. So it's like, the first thing is, like, what I'm doing isn't working. If what I'm doing isn't working, there might be a better way. That's two. And step three is, if there's a better way, why don't I go try it? You know, like, to me, step three is an action step. You know, we made a decision to turn our will and life over to God. There's that word, as we understood him. You know, again, when I first worked step three, I still did not have a God, but people told me it could be good, orderly direction. And, like, for me, step three, like, was really about, like, making a decision to continue on, like, working these steps, to go on to step four, and, like, to have enough faith that no matter what I went through, like, it wasn't going to be okay. I was not going to be guaranteed that, like, life was going to be easy, but I would be given the strength and the power to get through it. And a lot of that strength and power just comes from, like, you know, being secure in the love of the fellowship. Like, no matter what I would go through, there would be someone in this room who had either gone through it or who would sit by me while I was feeling it. You know, like, I didn't have to go through anything alone here. And around the time I was working step three, I had the opportunity to get in a relationship. And I remember being like, is this self-will? Is this God's will? And, like, trying to do that whole little dance. And finally, I was like, I'm just going to try it. And if it fails, like, I'll be okay. And, like, to me, like, step three is that's, like, permission to, like, fucking live my life in some ways, right? Like, I made a decision. And, like, if I make a decision and I don't like it, I get to make a new decision, right? And through all of that, like, I'm learning and I'm growing and I'm in the care of. And, you know, one of the reasons I didn't want to have a God is because, like, when I had been abused by my stepfather, I had prayed that it wouldn't happen anymore and it never stopped. And so I believe that, like, it didn't work. I was like, if there is a God, he fucking hates me. And I used to hate it when people would say, God won't give you anything more than you can handle. Because, like, I was like, I couldn't fucking handle this shit. It almost fucking killed me. And my mother, thank God for my mother sometimes, she was like, I like to say, life won't give me anything God can't handle. And it was like that shift in perspective that I needed. You know, because, like, it shifted it from God doing these things in my life, like, everything that happened in my life was, like, God's responsibility, to, like, this is life on life's terms, and I have a power greater than myself, right, whether that's the group, the program, or God, to help me deal with this fucking shit over here, because I don't know how the fuck to deal with it otherwise. And so then I got to step four, and the first, you know, again, I worked all my steps out of the basic text the first time around, and, like, I open up my basic text, and the first thing it says is, like, the purpose of the fourth step is to sort through the contradiction and confusion of our lives to find out who we really are, or something to that effect. And I read that line, and I cried for an hour, which probably won't surprise you at this point in time, because I talk about crying a lot when I was new. But the idea of sorting through that stuff to find out who I really was fucking terrifying, because the truth was, I had a core belief that I was nothing. Like, our basic text talks about, like, you know, we're afraid there's a monster inside of us that's gonna be released. Like, I wasn't afraid I was gonna find anything really, really fucking bad. I just thought I was fucking worthless. And I didn't wanna find that shit out. I didn't want that to be confirmed. And so, you know, I had my grief and my moment and I cried. And then I was like, all right, like, but I'm gonna keep doing this because all these other people in my life worked steps and they all seem to be fucking happy. And so I continued that process of sorting through that stuff. And like, what I found out was like, I'm neither as good or as bad as I think I am. Most of the things that I did, I was looking for love. I was looking for acceptance. You know, I was looking for an escape from the hurt. And the biggest thing was, is that the things that I did aren't who I am. They were just things that I had done, right? Like, they aren't the essence of who I am. And now that I'm practicing a new way of life, like, I do have things that are positive aspects about myself as well, right? Like, I'm not this horrible human being who's done these horrible things, you know, and, you know, I can show up for my mother. I don't have to be the daughter who, you know, makes her worry every fucking day. Like, I'm able to be of service to my home group, you know, like, those things, like, kind of, like, were bringing me back to life. And I'll be honest with you, I still struggle with this idea of, like, identity, because, like, I feel like people are this, like, beautiful, like, work in progress all the time, and, like, sometimes I, like, feel like I just got to know myself, and now I'm fucking changing again, which might seem weird to some people, but I think some people get it. But what I sometimes say to people is, like, but I'm okay with it. Like, it's like the idea that, like, I couldn't describe it to you, but, like, we all know blue when we see it, but I couldn't put blue into words. And it's like, I couldn't describe you, like, me to you, but, like, I know myself when I feel myself, like, my full self. Like, that spirit inside of me that no matter what I go through is, like, just that core essence of, like, a human being. Like, to me, that's just that spirit. And it's, you know, hard to put into words. So step five, I know it's not simply a reading of step four, but I basically read it to my sponsor, and she shared her experience with me. And it was pretty cool because I sat down with her to do step five, and she basically, like, she had a two-year-old who sat in my lap, and, like, I would read a page, and he'd rip it, and he'd just rip it into shreds. And it was like he was just getting rid of my past for me. And when I was done, like, you know, the things that I had felt the most shame and guilt about, she was like, you know, I've done those things too, right? Like, so I know it didn't feel, like, as much guilt and shame for having done them. It, like, helped make me feel, like, a little more human, a little bit more accepted, you know, and she was able to, like, put things into perspective for me. And then I went on to the steps 6 and 7, and the way she had me work 6 was right about a defect, how it applied to my life, and how I saw my life without it. And, you know, that was a really fun exercise. And at the end of it, you know, I basically realized that without a lot of my character defects, like, I'd be a little bit more productive. I wrote about laundry a lot. I was like, my laundry would be done if I don't have this defect. Because in my mind were, like, things like, you know, procrastination and laziness and, you know, all those fun things. And even to this day, I'll be honest, like, when I do my laundry, like, I, like, literally am, like, that person. I, like, get my clothes out of the dryer and they immediately go in my closet, because otherwise, like, it gets really out of control for me. I like kind of seeing people shake their heads at my fucking laundry story. Thank you. you know, some of my big character defects, like, you know, I couldn't even, like, tell you what I wrote on my first one, but I go through the steps again. Like, that's what I was taught to do with her, and, like, this is what my second sponsor did, and my current sponsor is the same way. And, like, even now with Years Clean, like, my biggest defects are, like, I still people please. It's fucking hard to get rid of that one. I don't like it about myself. You know, like, I can still fall into procrastination. I don't do it with my laundry, but I do it with other things. And, you know, like, to me, the idea of, like, step 6 is, like, I identify these things, and I want to get better with them. But part of step 7 is realizing that, like, no matter what I do, I'm always going to be human, right? Like, there's a word, humility, that starts this, you know, 7th step. And, you know, I had a woman who was in the area where I got clean, and she used to talk about the process of 6 and 7. Like, you know, like, at first I'm, like, doing all these things, I'm not even aware that I'm doing them. And then I get the awareness that I act on these defects, and I usually am aware of them after the fact. Like, you know, I think our text talks about, like, we see that hurt look in someone's eyes when we've, like, acted out on something that we shouldn't, you know, didn't really want to do. And then it's like, I'm aware of I'm doing them as I'm doing them, and I may not even want to do them, but I'm doing them anyway. and was, oh! And then she talked about, like, the moment of grace, right? Which is, like, to, she's like, you know, like, the moment you realize you're about to do it and you have that choice, right? And it's like, to me, we talk a lot about in recovery, like, we have the ability to respond instead of react. And I think that's what 6 and 7 really give me. And again, I don't always make the right choice. I don't always have all that awareness. Sometimes I still act on impulse. But damn, I'm a lot better today than I used to be. And not only that, but I'm no longer beating myself up for all the ways I fall short. One of my big defects of character is just, like, perfectionism, which is fucking unattainable, right? So, like, to me, part of 6 and 7, and like I said, that humility was like, hey, like, why don't you give yourself a break and, like, let that go a little bit? But it can still pop up. And when it's, like, up and it's in my, and I'm in my head and it's like, you know, you're not good enough, you're never going to be good enough, like, you fuck that up. Like, it can be really loud. And like, the most beautiful thing about this program is that, like, I can call someone and I can talk to them about it and they can, like, help put me back into, like, that right frame of mind again. You know, this whole thing starts with that word we, and we don't do it alone. So I got to step 8. I made a list of the people I had harmed. You know, I was really lucky in the fact that my mother had made amends to me during her process. And so I had seen what amends looked like from somebody else. And, you know, like, I got over my list with my sponsor. And the first time I went through the steps, I refused to put my dad on the list. Like I said, my dad moved away when I was 7 or 8 years old. And I thought to myself, how could I have caused someone harm if they're not here? And years later, my dad ended up collapsing, and he was put in a medically induced coma. And no matter what our parents do to us, like, a lot of times we still fucking love them. And I remember feeling so powerless and so helpless because I was so far away, and he was in a hospital bed, and I couldn't be there. And it made me think about the time I tried to kill myself when I ended up in the hospital, and the time I had my car accident and ended up in the hospital, and, like, how he must have felt. It was like I literally had to go through that experience to even have any empathy for the fact that I could have caused him harm. And so shortly after that, I started trying to repair my relationship with my dad. Both of my parents ended up relapsing when they found out about, like, the abuse. So, like, my dad moved to Colorado when he was still, like, clean or whatever, but, like, then, you know, when we would go visit him during the summer, like, we were getting high with him. Like, I got high with both my parents at some point in time. And so my dad was still drinking a lot, and so I would try to have a relationship with him, but it was really hard. He would say fucked up shit. But he was still my dad. And then he kept having these episodes where he kept collapsing. And, you know, I was working through the steps again at this time, and I got back to 8, and I was ready to put him on the list. And I remember going to a meeting and saying, like, I'm just really afraid I'm going to make amends to my dad. He's going to die. And people said, you're not that powerful. So in October of 2013, I flew to Colorado. One of the women that I had met through this program had actually just moved out there. She was, like, she was literally my best friend. She was my maid of honor at my wedding. And so her and I took a hike in the Rocky Mountains. And we talked about it, and her story to her dad was exactly like mine. She was the person who kind of guided me through the whole process. So the fact that she was the one who moved to Colorado was just one of those God moments. And then I made amends to my dad. And, you know, one of the biggest things that he said to me is, like, he's like, I'm proud of you. Like, I see the life that you built for yourself. He said, but the thing that I'm most impressed with is the fact that you seem happy. And that really meant the world to me. And part of my amends to him was that I told him that I forgave him. And he was able to explain to me, like, why he felt like he needed to leave, which was helpful in a way, but also kind of like, okay, dude, you'll never leave your fucking kids. And then he died. he died in 2014, in March of 2014, but he was in a medically induced coma for, like, the last 2 months of his life. So, I don't think I was that powerful. I just think my dad was, you know, really, really sick, and he was going to die no matter what I did. But I had the courage to still make those amends, and I was able to make them while he's still alive. And I have a sponsee right now who, her dad just went through a major thing, and she hasn't gotten to step 8 yet. And she was like, he had brain surgery to remove a tumor. She's like, I'm really afraid he's going to die. I feel like I need to say something. And I said, look, I said, whatever you say, just say you love him. say whatever you think you need to say in your heart, but just know that the process of amends isn't even about the words that we say, it's about how we live. And the fact that you are there right now with him is the amends. You know, it's how we live our lives that really is truly the amends. And so for like all of the amends that I make to everyone, including myself, it's really in how I show up for the people in my life today. And, you know, I'm just here trying to do my best. And like, that's how I make things right. 10, 11, and 12 are maintenance, right? I really, really, really love 10, 11, and 12. I always talk about this because I think it's important to talk about service. But how I did the 10th step is I read the Living the Recovery IP for 10 or for 30 days and wrote about it. And there's a question in there, who has trusted me today? And every Sunday night, I brought my home group. I had the key to my home group. They trusted me to show up. Like, being of service, like, puts back, like, that self-worth. Like, we talk about if you want self-esteem, do esteemable things. And, like, through service, like, being service in my home group, like, I was able to do those esteemable things and, like, start to rebuild that. And, like, I just think it's so fucking cool that, like, through that inventory process, I was able to recognize, like, who has trusted me today. Like, people in NA have trusted me today. And that's huge for me. And, you know, I'm finally okay with having a God of my understanding. Like, through this process, like, it changed over time. I said, like, I was determined to not have a God, but, like, when I wrote on resentments and four, God ended up on my list. And that sort of started that healing process for me to, like, have something that, again, kind of like the way I describe spirit would be the same way I describe God. I don't know what it is, but I know it when I feel it. I think sometimes it's just the love that's in the room, and I carry that with me. There's some universal life force energy. Like, it's the force from Star Wars, whatever that is. Like, it's just there. You know, through 11, like, I get quiet and I tap into that, and that helps guide me, and, you know, and that's the thing that gives me that strength to practice this in all my affairs and, like, try to carry this message to the addict who still suffers. The longer I'm here, I woke up one day and I was driving and I was doing I used to do this, like, meditation on the third step prayer. I would, like, say the lines and, like, think about what they meant. So I'd be like, take my will, and be like, what is my will? You know, and, like, a lot of times it'd be like, I want everyone to think I'm a good person, even if I don't put in the work. I want to be skinny without going to the gym or dieting or exercising. Like, these are, like, my will, right? What is my life? And I would think about my relationship and my career. And, like, it talks about turning our finances over. And I'd, like, imagine it all going to God. And then guide me in my recovery and show me how to live. And this one day I just had this light bulb, like, this is a way of life. And I'm living it. And I didn't even realize I was living it. But our message, an addict, any addict, can stop using, lose the desire to use, and find a new way of life. I have found a new way of life through Narcotics Anonymous, through working the steps, through showing up, through the love that I was shown, through being of service. And the amount of gratitude I have for the life that I'm living today compared to the person I was to when I came in here is, like, I can't put it into words, so I just keep showing up and I just do my best to give back, and that's all I have. Thanks for asking me to speak. Thank you.